A few things have changed since NHPR first began as Granite State Public Radio back in 1981.
Welcome WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire to the NPR and All Things Considered family.
But through it all, local listener support has made this station possible. And for a limited time, we'll send you a classic canvas tote featuring the retro Granite State Public Radio logo when you become an NHPR sustainer at the discounted rate of $13 a month. But don't wait. Give now at nhpr.org.
From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Democratic lawmakers in the New Hampshire House want members of the 400-member body who are medically vulnerable to COVID-19 to be able to meet remotely. The COVID effect leaves its mark on school budget funding, and some of the state's colleges and universities see a revival of pandemic-related restrictions as case numbers rise in those communities. It's been a busy week in news, and we'd love to hear from you, particularly about schools. Have you pulled your child out of public school during the pandemic? Are you planning to return to public school in the fall? And educators, what do you need from the state to make the upcoming year successful? Give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And to start the program off today, we'll speak with NHPR's education reporter, Sarah Gibson. Sarah, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with what Governor Sununu announced at his press conference yesterday. The big news out of that conference is that he would be signing an executive order requiring all schools to have at least a hybrid model of learning at least 2 days a week starting on March 8th.
It isn't just so the kids come back and have a more fuller, robust learning model. It really is for the behavioral and mental health, the isolation issues that so many of our students have been bearing with.
And this is a story that is evolving. We're learning more about this executive order to come, and there's some reporting on it at nhpr.org. Sarah Gibson, I wanted to ask you a little bit about what we know so far and also that comment in particular about students' mental health.
Yeah, that's something that is certainly on the minds of school leaders, guidance counselors, and parents, and it's a concern that's been raised with state agencies as well. And we see it playing out in so many facets. So, you know, when I talk to pediatric doctors or mental health professionals, they say kids who are at home isolated during the pandemic with lots of stressors in their home are really, really struggling, and that might be one of the reasons they're not engaging as much in remote learning. And then, there also is a sense that we've been doing this for a while now. And so there are these kind of straggler districts that are still largely remote, just a couple of them. As the governor said yesterday, most of these actually have plans in the works to, in March, reopen with the hybrid model. But this executive order would essentially mandate that. So both the districts that are fully remote, as well as charter schools that are fully remote, would need to have that in-person option, not just for struggling students, but for all students twice a week.
All right. Well, more to come on this executive order. Sarah Gibson, I did want to ask you about a story you did this week on how educators are increasingly turning to DCYF to check in on students who aren't showing up for school. Why are they turning to DCYF?
Right. So for a number of reasons. So basically, even before the pandemic, there was kind of a list of things a district does if it's losing track of a student, if there's chronic absenteeism, if parents aren't responding to calls and emails, if a truancy officer, you know, goes to the door and knocks and still can't track down a kid. Often what happens is that either a social worker or a local nonprofit gets involved, or the school basically calls the child abuse and neglect hotline at Child Protective Services here and makes a report. It says, we're worried about this kid. Here's what we've done to try to connect to them. Can you see what's going on? And so what ends up happening is that DCYF workers essentially investigate that and see whether or not it warrants opening a case. And in most cases right now, they're finding that, you know, there is no actual educational neglect per se, but there are a lot of challenges that families are facing that mean kids are just not logging into Zoom classes and are really struggling at home.
Yeah. So what are those challenges? What's the root cause of why a lot of these kids aren't showing up for their Zoom classes?
Well, there's a myriad of challenges. Some of them are a little bit easier to wrap one's head around, such as lack of connectivity to good internet, or you know, the Chromebooks that were issued in September from the school district aren't working anymore, that kind of thing. And that can be addressed because it's kind of a logistical, hands-on assistance that can be offered. The other things that I've heard about are a lot more nebulous and they're harder to address. Say the fact that both parents are working full time, they drop kids off at grandparents' house, and the grandparents have no idea how to use the internet and how to oversee Zoom classes. There's also a lot of examples I heard of people who maybe were made aware that there were tutoring programs or programs at the Boys and Girls Club, YMCA, or even opportunities to drop their kids off at school to get some in-person assistance. However, there's a transportation issue with that, particularly, again, if people are working full parents are working full time. So it really runs the gamut. The other thing I will say is that in households with a bunch of siblings, it's often up to the older sibling, maybe a middle schooler or high schooler, to help their younger siblings out, to kind of be the overseer of Zoom classes. What that means for the older students is that they're often the most chronically absent, but it's often because they're kind of filling certain family duties while everyone's at home.
And you spoke with DCYF Director Joseph Ribsom about this. What did he have to say?
Well, you know, he acknowledged that the issue of chronic absenteeism and truancy is real. I mean, many times districts have done, you know, a countless amount of things to get in touch with a family. They really can't. And so they call the state. But Ribsom said there needs to be greater effort to connect families to existing nonprofits, family resource centers, so that they're basically not having to involve the state. It basically should go school works with local nonprofits to connect to families rather than school calls the state. And then has a kind of robust intervention that sometimes is kind of excessive. If you know, it's not a great look if a family essentially feels like the school called the cops on them, and they get a knock on their door or a call. So I think in order to kind of restore trust and have a good relationship between schools and families, Ribsom is saying, let's make sure that we connect families to resources and nonprofits in the community rather than get Child Protective Services involved.
Listeners, we're taking some time in this part of the program to talk about the challenges both students and educators are facing. We'll also be talking about legislative efforts to fund education in the state. And we want to hear from you. Have you had challenges with making it to school? Or teachers, have you had issues reaching students? Let us know. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Sarah Gibson, you spoke with Erin Pettengill. She runs the Family Resource Center in Laconia, and she spoke about working with a single mom with four kids.
One might be remote, one might be in person, one might be remote, both might be remote, both might be in person, and then they've got two other children in the home full time, and mom is at her limit. So, you know, that's when we start talking to the school and we say, how can we best support this family? And, you know, in some cases, it is just going up to a window and working with the family that way, or going outside and going sledding with the child.
So various problems, various solutions, Sarah Gibson.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, Erin is from a Family Resource Center, which is one of those kind of community-based organizations that DCYF is recommending schools develop a robust relationship with during the pandemic, given the fact that, as we heard, you know, parents are just totally overwhelmed, and kids and parents are sometimes checking out because it just feels like too much to stay connected in a hybrid or remote learning model.
Worth mentioning that Lori Chibinet, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services, Also announced that the state will be temporarily designated 10 beds at New Hampshire Hospital to serve children with mental health crises. Worth noting that kids' mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic is going to be the subject of the exchange coming up on Wednesday. So if you'd like to weigh in on that for the Wednesday show, reach out to us now, exchange@nhpr.org. Sarah Gibson, I wanted to ask you a little bit about some legislative matters pertaining to education, including HB 20, the school choice bill that Republicans considered a top priority this session. It was retained by the House Education Committee by a vote of 20-0. What happened?
So what happened is many, many days worth of testimony as well as deliberation. And basically, Democrats and Republicans, while they have very different approaches to school choice, could agree that this just needs more time. It's a really big deal, this bill. It could change the landscape. It would change the landscape of school choice and could change the state's finances in terms of how it funds education, both to public schools as well as private schools and private programs. So there was an agreement that particularly with a last-minute amendment introduced on Wednesday, that there needed to just be more time to get this right. But it certainly isn't the end of school choice and voucher-like programs, because there's a very similar bill in the Senate that still is awaiting testimony and that will likely have strong Republican support, as well as pushback from those we heard in the House, Democrats, public school advocates, and others who are concerned about declining enrollment and declining investment in public schools.
Okay. And speaking of investment in public schools, Sarah, it's school budget season. What's different about this budget season when it comes to funding schools in New Hampshire?
Well, there are just more unknowns than usual. So school budget season is always kind of strangely timed, because people have to make decisions about how much they're spending on schools prior to knowing how much the state is going to give them. That's always the case for most districts. However, it's a little stranger this year because we're unsure how the state is going to deal with something called the COVID effect, which is basically usually the state relies on the last year's numbers of student enrollment and poverty levels collected by the districts in order to calculate how much aid to give those districts in the coming year. However, this year, there's something being termed the COVID effect on school funding, which is basically that enrollment is down, probably to some extent temporarily, as a lot of families chose to homeschool or go to private school during the pandemic. And also the typical way that districts calculate how many low-income students they have, which is through free and reduced lunch applications, that kind of went out the door because of some federal changes during the pandemic. So basically, schools are looking at less state aid next year based on these kind of funky pandemic numbers. That could be addressed through some legislative changes. But as of now, schools are kind of trying to build their budgets around less state aid than they got last year.
And what about the Commission to Study School Funding? The legislature created this. You've done some reporting on this. What did that commission find?
Sure. So that was a commission that came out of that emerged the same legislative session that there was a lot of energy and momentum around addressing the school funding formula. There was kind of this consensus that it's pretty outdated. We should probably do something about it. There's also a Supreme Court case looming over our heads. Let's look at school funding, see if there's something better we can do for more equitable distribution of funding, as well as just to address this fundamental question of how to fund schools as education costs rise. And the commission met throughout the pandemic all last year, and they basically found that the distribution of state aid was regressive. It hurt property poor communities and required really high tax rates in those communities. And something that's worth noting in the commission is that there's often an anxiety that a conversation about funding schools more, spending more money, more state money on schools, is kind of a Trojan horse for introducing an income tax or taxing Granite Staters and Granite State businesses more. That wasn't necessarily the conclusion. There are certainly proposals that would cost the state more money, but one of the possibilities proposed was basically using the current level of state aid, same amount, but distributing it differently so that low income and struggling districts basically get more of the state's share of educational aid. And that would require some changes, but it would retain the same kind of slice of the pie that that makes up the state budget, which is about 25% of state funding going to public schools already.
Listeners, we're speaking with NHPR's Sarah Gibson for another 10 minutes or so about school budgets, schools during the pandemic. What concerns do you have? What questions do you have? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Karen from Laconia sent us an email. She writes, "There seems to be consensus that schools can open with proper safety measures, but what does that entail? Do all New Hampshire schools have the resources to implement the guidelines with needed improvements to ventilation, for example? I worry that poorer districts could be at greater risk for a COVID outbreak." Sarah Gibson, what do you make of Karen's email?
That is a great question, and I'm glad Karen asked it, because that's a major concern that's been raised. I do want to point out, however, that federal funding, COVID relief to schools, has been allocated in part based on poverty levels. So it's kind of Title I is this, we will not get into it. It's pretty in the weeds, but basically there's a distribution model of federal funding that has been used for COVID relief aid. So we actually have a map on nhpr.org where you can see how much money each district has gotten from the Fed so far to pay for pandemic related expenses. So there are poorer districts that have gotten a substantial increase in federal aid this year to pay for things like upgrades to the HVAC system, PPE for teachers, sanitation equipment, plexiglass barriers. So that is to some extent being covered by federal relief aid. There's more expected on the way under the Biden administration in the next couple of months. And so, schools say, yeah, we're getting some more money for this, but we have no idea what these expenses are going to look like next year because we don't know what's going to happen with the pandemic in, the months and year to come.
What about the concept of donor towns? To what extent is this a thing? Are towns participating in a system where they would be sending more money to other less well-off towns?
Yeah. So this is a concern that kind of crops up every couple of years as there's a discussion in the State House about whether or not to change how the state funds public schools. And, without getting too in the weeds about it, there's basically something called the statewide property tax and education property tax. And the initial idea of this was that state would collect the tax from towns, from taxpayers, and then it would distribute that to school districts. Right now, what happens is that wealthier towns are basically able to retain that property tax, that revenue from property taxes, and spend it on their own school district. So places like Portsmouth or Newington, Hanover, wealthier towns can retain their money, they spend it on their local school districts, and they're nervous that if there's a new school funding model, they'll basically have to send more of that money over to Concord, and that money will go to places like Manchester and Berlin and Claremont and Nashua, where the property values per student are lower and where the student performance tends to be not quite as high. And so there's nervousness that those places will become quote-unquote donor towns, sending more of their tax money to towns that are less fortunate than them.
And is there a bill in the legislature that would make that a reality right now?
Well, a couple different bills have been proposed, but to be totally frank, there just isn't a ton of appetite to overhaul the school funding formula this mm-hmm. year. There's so much on people's minds. Not all lawmakers are even meeting in person right now. And so, to really hammer out a school funding formula that is a dramatic shift, that satisfies needs of different kinds of towns and taxpayers and lawmakers. It's a huge, huge task. And frankly, it's a little hard to imagine that happening this legislative session and during the pandemic. So yes, there are some proposals to change the school funding formula. Is the appetite for this there? I would say depends on who you ask, but it certainly does not seem to be the number one educational priority this legislative session.
All right, got it. One more thing to talk about with you, Sarah. The CDC released guidelines for school operations recently, but the state didn't seem to want to change its approach to schools. So give us the rundown. What did the CDC say, and why was the state unmoved by it?
Well, the CDC, reiterated some of the important mitigation measures that schools need to have in place, which a lot of schools in New Hampshire already do, things like social distancing, mask wearing, sanitation. There are a couple of additional components, though, that the CDC recommended that New Hampshire says is that state leadership, the Commissioner of Education, as well as Dr. Benjamin Chan, say are just going to be too hard to fulfill and are unnecessary. And so, for example, the CDC says if you're in an area with a really high community spread of COVID-19, you should not be fully open, meaning hybrid might be okay, but don't try to open your doors 4 or 5 days a week. However, that is happening in New Hampshire, and it has been happening for a while. I mean, we've been getting through a significant surge in the last couple of months, and schools certainly did have to close temporarily, but a bunch did stay open. And so there is a sense, at least among some districts and among state leadership, that you can keep schools open even when transmission is really high. The other thing to note is that there's been a lot of disagreement here in New Hampshire about when to vaccinate teachers and whether or not teachers need to be vaccinated prior to reopening schools. That is something the CDC says is not necessary. They say teachers should be prioritized, but they do not have to be vaccinated in order to start to safely reopen schools, as long as these other mitigation measures are put into place.
And overall, Sarah, as you continue to report on this, what are you hearing from school administrators about their concerns?
Well, one thing I've heard about in relation to vaccination is that so much of the reason that schools had to shut down is not because there's massive transmission within the building. That's not necessarily happening. We have a couple outbreaks, a couple clusters that we hear about every so often. But what's really happening is that when community transmission is high, there's a lot of exposure that happens in the community. So it could be that 3 teachers are out because of being exposed outside of school, and a bunch of students have been exposed outside of school. So it stops making sense to have in-person classes. There's not the staff to do so. And so the school goes remote, which is really disruptive for families. It's frustrating for students, and it's frustrating for administrators. And so that's one of the reasons why everyone says we cannot wait to get vaccinated, because that'll change the extent to which people need to stay home and teach remotely or take time off after potential exposure. So that's a kind of that's one of the arguments made for why, once teachers are vaccinated, things could look pretty different, even without a pediatric vaccine. And the other thing we're hearing certainly is that even as the vaccination happens and the vaccination rollout occurs, there are going to need to be mitigation measures for months to come. And so, there's a request for patience from parents and families, because things are not going to look normal, maybe even in September. They could be normal maybe in a year from now, but there might be more mitigation measures. There might be social distancing. There might be some mask wearing that happens during summer school and that happens during the fall semester. So people are being encouraged to really kind of buckle up and find the best solutions possible, but to recognize that things are not going to be normal in a couple of months.
Oof, that's tough to hear for people who may be hitting a pandemic wall right about now, or maybe they hit it a long time ago. Let's take a quick call from Henry in Troy. Henry, thank you very much for calling.
Good morning, Peter. Great show. I just wanted to make a couple comments. first comment is about the schooling and how children are dealing with the models. So I have two kids in the Monadnock School District. One is in elementary school. The other is in high school. The district is in a hybrid model. So kids go to school every other day. And on the remote days, they are using Zoom lessons. I believe as long as parenting is set up and there are clear expectations, kids can thrive in this environment. And my kids have managed to, you know, continue learning and get good grades and stay on top of the education aspect. So the district has done a really good job assigning schoolwork for remote days. The other comment is regarding the ventilation and mitigation techniques. So somebody mentioned ventilation. Most schools in New Hampshire do not have ventilation systems that would handle the higher rated MERV filters that would actually prevent COVID. So they need to implement mask wearing in class, in person. Mm-hmm. And as long as that's done, our district has done a really good job managing any outbreaks. We have had less than 4 cases in a high school and maybe 3 cases at the elementary school.
Well, Henry, thank you very much for your insights. Really appreciate it. Yeah, so hybrid working for some like Henry. We've heard other stories where it's not quite the ideal situation for others. And then concerns about ventilation. Sarah, seems like it's familiar territory for you.
It's very familiar, yeah. And I so appreciate Henry calling in, because while hybrid is not ideal, I certainly hear from teachers who say it is so much better than not seeing my students for 5 weeks, right? So there is, you know, I was just in Manchester. I was in a school yesterday for the first time during the pandemic, and the level of gratefulness and enthusiasm to connect to kids in person was just profound. This is a high school that is, now hybrid. A lot of families are choosing to stay fully remote out of concern about COVID, but it is hybrid. Kids can come into the building, and the extent to which those in-person connections are transforming kids' second semester is just really profound to witness. So, hybrid is not working for everyone. It's not as good as fully in-person, but I certainly hear stories of ways that it is a good temporary solution for now.
And NHPR education reporter Sarah Gibson. You can find links to her stories at nhpr.org. Sarah, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll speak with NHPR's Josh Rogers about news in the State House and the governor's proposed tax cuts. He's proposed cuts to the meals and rooms tax, interest and dividends tax, and the business enterprise taxes. Listeners, what do you think about these tax cuts? Let us know. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Roundup. Back in a minute. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for tuning in. Democrats in the New Hampshire House have sued to allow state reps who are at greater risk of dying or suffering other severe consequences of COVID-19 to attend House sessions remotely. For more on this, we turn to NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers. Hey, Josh. I'm sorry, Josh, are you there?
Good morning.
Hey, there you are. Listeners, if you have thoughts on lawmakers at high risk of complications with COVID-19 or about the state budget, which we're going to be talking about in a little bit, give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. Josh, on the subject of in-person House meetings, this lawsuit was filed by Representative Rennie Cushing, who has stage 4 cancer, and 6 other lawmakers. What is their argument? What are they saying about why they should be able to attend sessions remotely?
Well, they say essentially that the legislature has the ability to meet remotely. The state's highest court said last year that the legislature could meet remotely and still comply with the Constitution, and that they're basically saying under the Americans with Disabilities Act, they should be permitted to attend sessions remotely, people who would be susceptible to being protected under that act. Not every lawmaker, but just those with serious health conditions. My understanding is some 20 lawmakers have complained seeking accommodation, and it's going to go before a federal judge today. This is not something that the federal courts wanted to take up. They suggested that Republican leaders and Democratic leaders get together and sort this. House Speaker Sherman Packard has said that basically without a House rule contemplating remote sessions, it's inappropriate to have remote sessions or to grant people a remote option. And that's kind of where we stand. It's going to be interesting to see where this ends up. The House Republicans didn't want to adopt a rule to allow remote sessions. And they say logistically it's more complicated than Democrats make it out to be. And they say that the sessions planned for next week, which they've arranged to be held at a sports complex in Bedford that has a 50,000 square foot floor, provides adequate safety, and that there will be safety plans that have been developed in concert with state and local health and safety officials that can keep lawmakers safe.
Yeah, House Speaker Sherman Packard says in the past, meeting at the Whittemore Center, for example, was very safe. He says nobody got COVID at those meetings. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I mean, it's unclear. I mean, the Speaker's office has been pretty firm that they don't believe that a remote solution that meets what they call the chamber's unique needs is out there. Democrats would say that they've been trying to get to yes with the Speaker for some time, and that, to quote Representative Cushing, the Democratic leader, says that he just doesn't think that Speaker Packard believes in the idea of meeting remotely. And, Speaker Packard presides over what has traditionally been a pretty restive Republican caucus. I mean, we're talking about Republicans who declined to wear masks at some of these remote sessions held at UNH. I mean, we obviously had the drive-in session. Packard says he doesn't believe that's practicable in the middle of winter. There are a lot of people in the GOP caucus who believe that the House could more or less get back to business, as is. And, this is the only reason Packard ended up Speaker, obviously, because former Speaker Dick Hinch died of COVID. We obviously don't know the exact how he contracted it, but I mean, this came on the heels of came a week after he was won the Speaker's gavel outdoors at UNH, but came on the heels of Republican gatherings inside where some went maskless. And so there is definitely a different cultural orientation between the caucuses on what ought to be done to protect the health and safety of the members during a pandemic. Mm-hmm. The House is not necessarily the spryest group of 400 people in the state. We're talking about an average age of topping 60. At times it can feel like a sick bay at the state house in the best of times. And so there's certainly a lot of people people who've joined this lawsuit who say they feel that Speaker Packard's putting them in a position to, do their duty or put their safety and even their life at risk.
And has Representative Rennie Cushing, who has filed this lawsuit, suggested ways for those members who want to stay remote to stay remote while everybody else meets in person? Is there a way to do that?
He believes basically that it can be done via software, Zoom, essentially. Republicans have countered that the Zoom contract, and I confess I have not looked at the terms and conditions of the contract the state has with Zoom to facilitate remote legislative operations, is that, it's more complicated, and that to allow people to participate, logistically, it's not as easy as has been advertised. But even some of the committee operations in Zoom have been made complicated. I mentioned in a story I did last week about in the Ways and Means Committee, for instance, the eldest member of the committee, Mary Griffin, who tops 90 years old, she doesn't have a computer with a camera on it, and therefore, under the method of operations that the speaker prefers, shouldn't be allowed to vote because other committee members can't see her. And so it's sort of an awkward situation where you've had people on both sides of the aisle in the Ways and Means Committee saying, well, we obviously recognize Representative Griffin's voice and, can't she vote? And, the answer from leadership was like, if she can't be seen, she can't vote. And, critics, some Republicans have told me they thought that they think that the speaker's maybe being a bit rigid about this, but this is where we are. There's going to be a hearing in federal court this morning. We'll see where this ends up when the federal judge said, why don't you folks sort this out on your own? She indicated, this is not, federal courts don't necessarily want to get involved in the workings of a state legislature. I think that that tends to be the norm, and was hoping there could be agreement. You know, there hasn't been thus far, and right now it's barring an order from the court stopping these meetings next week in Bedford. That will be, you know, where the House next meets.
Let's go to the phones and take a quick phone call. James in Concord. James, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm a little bit flabbergasted listening to this. My wife is a state rep. We have 3-year-old twins and a 4-month-old child at home. She's a Democratic rep. The idea that whatever happens in this court case today is going to only apply to people with who the ADA applies to. That doesn't count people who have kids at home. That doesn't count. I mean, the idea that somehow the state of New Hampshire House is special compared to every other organization in the country that's been going remote for the last year is insane. The Republicans don't know how to use this technology. They're scared of losing control by using this technology. That is the only thing stopping them from going remote. They don't know how to use it to their advantage.
Well, James, thank you very much. Josh, is that something you've heard? Is that in general, is it possible to even say that a certain party is less technologically savvy and can't do it because of that?
Well, I don't think the House, broadly, given its demographics, is, you know, having sat in a lot of these committee hearings, you know, there's certainly no more technologically savvy than the average person. Okay. And I do think there is some truth that whether or not there's a sort of a, you know, political angle on this, as James suggested, or whether it's just a sort of cultural comfort with being remote. And, you know, he mentioned that, you know, the New Hampshire House thinks it's different than every other entity in the world. You know, exceptionalism is something that is really deep in the sort of warp and woof of the House culture. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, certainly on the GOP side, we've had lawmakers who have said, you know, I can't be stopped for speeding years past on the way to session because of a, you know, provision that says magistrates can't block, you know, members of the general court while they're heading to hearings, you know, something that remains, you know, sort of on the books, but a vestige from the colonial period, basically. So, you know, certainly the House is very particular about being told how it's going to act. That is deeper, that's deeply woven into particularly Republicans who consider themselves sort of constitutional conservatives. We have a lot of those in the House. And, you know, the caucus doesn't want to promulgate rules for meeting remotely. I think it's fair to say Democrats tried to introduce rules. They were rejected. We'll see where this ends up.
Well, Josh, our time is short. I do want to ask you one thing about revenues and taxes included in Governor Sununu's budget, because he handed off his state budget to the House Finance Committee this week. His budget plan includes a cut to the meals and rooms tax from 9% to 8.5%. It begins to phase out tax on interest and dividends. For those watching state revenues, they might say, isn't this going to be a huge loss in revenue to the state? And if so, where's that going to be made up so the state can pay for the things it needs to pay for?
Well, those are good questions, and those are something that the lawmakers are going to be hashing out between now and you know, late June. You know, the governor says that strong business tax collections, strong real estate transfer tax collections, strong liquor sales, those sorts of things are going to make up losses. You know, we will see. No governor gets everything they want. There is definitely an appetite within the Republican majorities to cut taxes. And, you know, the governor made an interesting choice in the way he's pitched these tax cuts as being something that benefits everybody. He's pitched the interest of dividends tax as something that benefits seniors. He's pitched raising the threshold on the BET as something that will boost small businesses. And, you know, he's not touching the rate to the business profits tax, which is something that a lot of people expected him to try to reduce, which suggests that, you know, he's cognizant of the fact that, you know, business property tax is paid by large companies, a lot of them out of state. And, you know, maybe he's sensitive to the critique that is sure to come from Democrats. But also he will get some of these tax cuts. But, you know, no governor gets everything they want in a budget. But there's definitely an appetite among Republicans to try to reduce taxes, even if in something like the rooms and meals tax, I mean, dropping it from 9 to 8.5, you know, the governor says, you know, that's the sort of thing that might make a difference for somebody going out to eat. You know, I'm not sure that's the case, but it's, you know, sort of all wrapped up into the notion that any tax cut creates some sort of notional advantage to you know, a business-friendly climate, which is what he's trying to propagate.
Well, NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Peter.
Still to come, we'll talk about the rise in COVID-19 cases on college campuses throughout the state. You can give us a call if you have questions or comments about that. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Yesterday at the governor's weekly coronavirus press briefing, state officials highlighted numbers moving in a positive direction. Fewer hospitalizations, fewer deaths, a lower test positivity rate, lower case numbers. But state epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan says the average new cases of COVID-19 were not following this positive trend.
The last few days, the daily number of new infections that we have announced has started to slightly increase. Part of the reason for this increase actually is that we are actually seeing more infections in the last few days at some of our colleges and universities, which I'm sure many of you are aware of. And in fact, out of these 461 new people today diagnosed with COVID-19, 141 of those are associated with colleges and universities. And so in the last week, we've been averaging probably about 90 new infections per day at colleges and universities throughout our state.
And for more on this, we turn to the Chief of Police and Associate Vice President for Public Safety and Risk Management at the University of New Hampshire, Chief Paul Dean. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back.
So, Chief Dean, UNH has moved to orange mode. What does that mean?
Well, what that is a pause and restrictions to some of our activities. We did that to basically de-densify the community and slow the spread. And it's been in our plans right from the beginning in the fall. And so we're really pleased that we're starting to see some results from that.
Okay. And how many cases does UNH have right now of COVID-19?
I don't have access to the newest chart that came out, but the number of cases have been going down the last several days from where they were last week. So we're starting to see a decline.
Okay. And Governor Sununu said at his press conference that college kids like to socialize. So does that explain the spike or is it something else?
No, in talking with DHHS, we talk on a regular basis with them. And, you know, we're starting to see, I think what everybody's feeling is COVID fatigue. And, you know, we're working with students. We're trying to get them to continue to follow. And the vast majority are doing that. It's still a problem.
And where are students once they get COVID-19? Are they kept in a specific place or are they staying sheltered where they live?
We have options for them. Right now, only our on-campus students are in our isolation and quarantine dorm. Off-campus students who move off-campus and are not part of student housing can quarantine or isolate in a private house or their home. And many are choosing to go home with that.
Mm-hmm. And what about testing? How is UNH testing its students?
You know, the UNH testing that's really the story here of success. You know, we're identifying these students who are symptomatic and put in quarantine, and then they're transitioning over to isolation early. And what that does is when you put somebody in quarantine, it stops the spread. And when that person does become symptomatic, they moved over to the isolation dorm. And so the only way you can do that is through a robust testing program. And that robust testing program has been just the best thing that we were able to do, not only for the campus, but for the community.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the community, how are you working with the community of Durham and surrounding communities?
You know, it's funny you said that. I just came off one of our regular calls with the town. You know, we have a symbiotic relationship with the town of Durham. We work so closely on many issues. And honestly, the silver lining to COVID for me is the amount of work we've been doing together in this circle, but expanding it out. Our relationship with the Durham landlords, we meet every other week with them. They're just a major player. And they're in lockstep with not only the town, but the university and trying to help us fight that. We started an off-campus task force led by Ken Holmes, our senior vice provost. And, you know, we're going door to door, talking with students, identifying locations that might be problematic, and having that conversation with them. And it's been really, really good.
And, Chief Dean, we really appreciate your time. Chief Paul Dean, Chief of Police and Associate Vice President for Public Safety and Risk Management at the University of New Hampshire. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Take care.
And let's get the view from off campus now from Todd Selig, Town Manager for the Town of Durham. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Great to have you. And many of your residents are affiliated with the university there in Durham, and the town is so intertwined with the college. So what do you make of the recent spike in cases?
Yeah, so I was listening to Paul Dean's comments, and he's exactly right in what he was conveying. What we're seeing is COVID fatigue amongst the student body, particularly those kids who are living off campus in off-campus student housing. You know, typically the kind of activity we might see that people think of as a party would be, you know, 50 people, 100 people, loud noise. And we're not seeing that, but what we are seeing is smaller groups of 10 or 15 getting together off campus. And in these COVID times, it's just as problematic. You know, these are kids getting together with no masks, close proximity, poor ventilation, and the cases just spread.
Yeah, and how are you responding as a town to this?
Well, as Chief Dean noted, we're working really closely with the university. We're working with the student body as well. The Student Senate has been incredibly proactive. And we're really trying to get out the word that, you know, if you value spending in-class time together, you need to really come together and ensure that you're following the protocols. You know, wear those masks, physical distance, don't gather in large groups. And we're starting to see increased compliance, and we're starting to see a positive trend where case numbers are starting to decline on a daily basis. So that's good news.
Mm-hmm. And are you hearing anything from town residents about the situation? And if so, what are they saying?
Yeah, town residents are really concerned. You know, they want to be comfortable going to the store, going downtown to eat, you know, spending time out and about in the community. And at the present time, with today's count is 411 active COVID cases attributed to Durham in particular, we've got the highest case count in the state, almost twofold. So that's of great concern to residents. But, you know, we've been very proactive from the start of the pandemic. We have a mask mandate downtown. Residents know the drill, you know, wear a mask, physical distance, avoid large crowds. And They're very compliant. And even downtown, you know, we're seeing good compliance amongst students walking around. They've got masks on if they're with other people. And so, you know, this is a difficult time. It's been a difficult time across the nation. And, you know, some of the trends that we were seeing, you know, following Thanksgiving and following Halloween, where people got together and there were subsequent spikes in cases, you know, that's what's going on here right now. So once the college students begin to fall in line with the protocols again, I think that we'll see those case counts decline.
Well, Todd Selig, Durham Town Manager, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Worth mentioning that Plymouth State University is the latest higher education institution in New Hampshire to go back to online classes because of a growing number of student COVID-19 cases. The university said Tuesday it had just about run out of quarantine isolation space. All campus events, including athletic competitions, have been canceled, and all gatherings have been limited to no more than 6 people. Before we sign off today, I want to take a look at where we are in this phase of the pandemic with NHPR's Casey McDermott. Casey, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So we mentioned earlier in this segment that a lot of metrics are moving in a positive direction, but that does not necessarily mean that the picture is rosy. So, Casey, where are we now in terms of cases, hospitalizations, deaths compared to where we have been recently?
Yeah, so I think the way to look at it is that the surge that we saw really, really intensify over the course of December and January has abated in a big way. However, we're kind of back down to the levels that we were like at the beginning of December, right before things got really, really intense. So if you think about that, I'm looking, for example, at NHPR's case tracker right now, and our averages in terms of the number of new cases we're reporting each day as of yesterday was about 360. And that puts us roughly where we were at, you know, the end of November, beginning of December. Which is much higher than we saw for really most of the early fall, and even, you know, much of the pandemic before that. So we have a ways to go to really bring those numbers down.
Okay.
Much more. And the same can really be said for hospitalizations as well.
What about outbreaks at nursing homes and jails?
So that's another area where it is moving in a good direction. We got an update from the state yesterday indicating that we are down to, according to their information, just 11 active outbreaks in long-term care facilities or jails or other congregate living settings. Of those 11 outbreaks, one is at the state prison for men. That's been going on for a pretty long time. There are two other jails, and then the rest of them are long-term care facilities, as far as we can tell. That's down from, at one point, you know, several dozen outbreaks at those types of facilities, you know, a month or two ago. So it's moving in the right direction, but still, you know, some of those have been ongoing for a while. And, you know, there have been a considerable number of deaths over the course of the pandemic at those facilities.
Casey, we've been talking a little bit about college students and the rise of COVID-19 in some college towns. To what extent are young people responsible for driving this latest surge?
So I'll preface this by saying I'm not an epidemiologist. So this is just based on the data that I'm looking at. But according to the state's dashboard, taking, for example, the average new cases as of yesterday, a few days ago, the 17th, you know, the 20 to 29 year old age group saw, you know, an increase in cases over the last few weeks, whereas most other age groups saw either, you know, pretty steady leveling off of cases or declines in cases. So that combined with what we're hearing from the public health experts does kind of reinforce the idea that we're seeing a lot of growth in young adults in particular, and perhaps tied to those college campus outbreaks that you were talking about.
Okay. Well, regardless of the age of the person with COVID, how does New Hampshire compare to other states in terms of case numbers? Is there a way to compare?
Yeah. So I would point people to two good resources on this, one of which is NPR, of which we are, of course, a member. They have some really good graphics on their website comparing different risk levels for COVID-19 by state. And according to their graphics right now and the data that they are working from, New Hampshire is actually still considered a high risk state. Looking at our kind of peers across New England, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, as of today, according to NHPR, are still at the highest COVID risk level. And what that means, according to NPR, is that we're reporting at least 25 new daily cases per 100,000 people. So they adjust for population, taking into account that, you know, of course, we have a different, you know, size of our community than other more populous states. For comparison, Vermont and Maine are at the orange level. So that's a slightly lower risk level. But that also kind of just reinforces the idea that, you know, yes, it's great that our numbers are moving down or, you know, down from where they were a month ago, for example. But We still have a lot of work to do to you know, ensure that it's fully under control.
And what about vaccines, Casey? Because yesterday state officials said about 5% of Granite Staters have been fully vaccinated and 11% have received one shot of the vaccine. How are we doing? How is New Hampshire doing compared to other states when it comes to vaccinations?
So I think, I think it's kind of a mixed picture there. I think that we, we all have different approaches that different states are using. I will say we actually don't get the data, the detailed data breakdown from the state on vaccines until Friday. So what I would say is that people can go to NHPR over the weekend once we get that and update our graphics to get a better sense of both where things stand right now and also how much farther we have to go. When you're looking at how the state plans to expand eligibility to a larger group of people over the next few months.
A few weeks ago, we were hearing a lot of complaints about the vaccine registration system. The state made some adjustments. The tenor of the conversation about that seems to have lost a bit of intensity. But what are you hearing, Casey? Is the new system working a little better or are things improving at least a little bit?
So I would defer to the reporting that, you know, my colleague Todd Bookman has been doing on this. I think we are still hearing a lot of just questions about how the system works. This is obviously a new experience for a lot of people that are going through this. I think that, you know, the state has said that they've been addressing some of the issues that people were running into in terms of scheduling, not just first appointments, but those second follow-up appointments. And, you know, what we've heard from state officials is that they are, you know, working to fix those issues. We are still hearing some questions, complaints, or challenges that people are running into getting those appointments scheduled or just sorting through the system. So that's something that I think we're going to continue to keep an eye on as well.
Well, NHPR's Casey McDermott, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
And listeners, just a reminder that if you've got questions about the state's vaccine rollout, we've got a frequently asked questions page and information that's up to date at nhpr.org/vaccines. That's it for today. But remember, you can find all the links to the stories that we discussed today at nhpr.org. And also just a reminder that coming up on Tuesday of next week, that's February 23rd, acclaimed author and former NPR host Diane Rehm will join me for the latest installation of our series, Writers on a New England Stage. We'll speak about her recent book, When My Time Comes, Candid Conversations on the Medical Aid in Dying Movement. Tickets to this remote event are just $5. And you can get them at themusichall.org. Writers on a New England Stage is a partnership between the Music Hall and NHPR. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show was produced by Christina Phillips. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Jessica Hunt and Jane Vaughn produced the show, and senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
Expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.